This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
The unemployment rate last month dropped to 8.6%. So has the economic mood started shifting? From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Mitchell Hartman, in for Jeremy Hobson. It's the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org for Friday, December 2nd.
Happy Friday. Coming up, is the latest plan to save Europe any different from the last one?
Cheeseheads could get, well, cheesier.
And a cautionary tale. Well, make that a slithery tale. In India, all that coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
The nation's unemployment rate dropped by nearly 0.5% between October and November. The Labor Department today said the economy created 120,000 jobs last month. Let's begin our coverage this morning and get some thoughts from Jill Schlesinger, editor-at-large at CBS Money Watch, and she's with us from New York City, as she is every Friday morning. Hey, Jill.
Good morning.
So, all right, why the big drop in the unemployment rate? I mean, but only, and I say only, 120,000 jobs were created.
Well, you know, it's really very confounding, but there are two different surveys, one for the unemployment rate, one for the jobs added. And part of the reason the rate went down so much was that we saw a decline in the labor force, over 300,000 people, fewer people. And that does distort the numbers so much, a bit, I should say, and could maybe be reversed when we see the December report next.
I know, Jill, with reports today that leaders in Europe are really attacking the debt crisis there. And then there's today's relatively positive employment report. I mean, has the mood in the economy shifted, do you think?
Well, it may be. And I'll say that for today only, because if things were to collapse tomorrow in Europe or over the weekend, I think we would see a complete reversal of fortune. But for today, I think you take the news as it comes. You say, look, the labor force is getting a little bit better. We are seeing marginally better numbers from month to month. And there is some steadiness to that. In Europe, if this cloud of uncertainty lifts, I really believe this is probably the biggest impediment to making the U.S. economy and the stock market grow. So without the Europe problem, I think we would be feeling a lot better and we'd see more positive results. I'm just going to take it for what it is, a pretty decent Friday. Go out and do some holiday shopping.
So an economic mood that shifted with an asterisk, right?
Yeah, for today.
Just for today. All right, Jill Schlesinger joining us from New York. Jill, thanks.
Take care.
Let's dig a little deeper this morning into these job numbers and what they mean for the economy. Chris Lowe is chief economist with FTN Financial, and he's with us from New York. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Mitchell.
So if we're adding 120 or 130,000 jobs month after month now, that's pretty good, isn't it?
You know, it actually it is. It's a really decent improvement over the lack of job growth we've seen earlier this year. But as Ben Bernanke, Fed chairman, keeps reminding us, it's not good enough if we want to make a significant dent in the tens of millions of unemployed. Still, better than it was.
And in fact, I know that the revisions have been suggesting that we may even be creating slightly more jobs.
So, well, that's exactly right. Yeah.
And what explains, though, the big decline in the unemployment rate? It's not every month that we see it fall so much. You might expect if it is falling that sharply, we'd be creating 300,000 or 400,000 jobs a month, which we're obviously not.
Well, yeah, there's two things going on here. One of them is that the unemployment rate comes from a different survey. So the 120,000 jobs a month, that was from something called the payroll survey. It's a survey of employers. There's also a household survey where they're contacting the workers themselves. And that one shows slightly different results. In the last 4 months, in fact, it shows significantly faster job growth. And if that's all you knew about the economy. In fact, you'd think the economy was booming. The average is more than 300,000 jobs a month in the last 4 months. But it also measures the labor force, that is, the number of people who are actively looking for work. In November, we saw something I have never seen before. That is, 275 people say they found jobs, and at the same time, 315,000 people said they became so frustrated they stopped looking for jobs.
Wow, that is not as good as it sounds at the top of the newscast here. Chris Lowe at FTN Financial in New York, thanks very much.
Thank you.
With a pretty big drop in the unemployment rate, you can imagine there are probably some smiles in the Obama administration today. Alan Krueger is chairman of the White House Council of Economic Advisors, and he's with us now from Washington. Professor, welcome to Marketplace.
Good morning.
So looks like some good news, right?
I think the picture that we get from today's employment report is that the economy is continuing to heal from the very deep recession that started at the end of 2007 and accelerated in 2008. But the size of the hole is pretty deep. It's going to take us a while to dig our way out, but we're headed in the right direction. And I think it's particularly fortunate that Congress passed the payroll tax cut and extended unemployment benefits at the end of last year at the president's urging. I think it's important to continue those policies.
300,000 people, though, stopped looking for work last month, more than that, actually, which makes that rate, that 8.6% unemployment rate, look a lot better than it actually is. I mean, why have that many people given up looking for work?
Well, about half of the drop in the unemployment rate was due to a drop in labor force participation, and about half was due to job growth. One of the things we've seen, if you look at the labor market as a whole, is that the long-term unemployed have been staying in the labor force. And I think one of the things that has helped them to stay in the labor force is extended unemployment benefits. Unemployment benefits require people to search for a job. And on top of that, they obviously help households to meet their bills, pay for their mortgages, and that supports the economy overall. I think what we need to do is kind of focus on the pace of job growth. Ultimately, that's what's going to put Americans back to work. And in particular, it has to be private sector because state and local governments are in very difficult budget situations. They're continuing to lay off workers. What we would like to see happen is a quickening of the pace of private sector job growth.
I want to change gears just a bit and talk about Europe and the ongoing debt crisis there. That has to have you guys concerned. I mean, if things get worse there, could that drag down U.S. job growth even more?
Well, developments in Europe are a major risk for the world economy. 20% of our exports go to Europe. If there's a slowdown in Europe, that will affect their demand for our products. I think that's one of the reasons why it's important that we strengthen our own domestic demand. And two ways of doing that are extending the payroll tax cut and also extending unemployment benefits. I think you're absolutely right that it's important to monitor what's going on in Europe, and I think it's important for members of the European Monetary Union to address their problems.
Alan Krueger, Chairman of the White House Council of Economic Advisors. Chairman, thank you.
Thank you very much, Steve.
The new job numbers come at a time as Congress debates once again whether to extend unemployment benefits. This week we've been asking whether keeping out-of-work Americans on unemployment benefits discourages them from looking for work. New Hampshire Public Radio's Dan Gorenstein reports.
Mary Jane Bickford's got skills. She's verified home titles for 16 years. She's worked as an administrative assistant and a legal secretary, too. In 6 months, she's had two nibbles. Bickford says she's got no idea how to find a job.
I was just talking to somebody, and I said, you know, what do you have to do? Do you have to write all over your resume and say, please, pick me, pick me?
That frustration is all too familiar to Cindy Dabrowski.
At the end of the day, we leave here pretty depressed with the stories that we hear.
Dabrowski is an unemployment counselor at the New Hampshire Department of Employment Security.
You feel for them because you feel responsible. You know, they're looking to you for advice, and you give them your best advice, and they adhere to it and do everything they can, and yet the jobs still aren't coming.
Dabrowski says most of her clients are like Bickford. decent people trying to claw their way back into the workforce. What they're slamming into is the brick wall of a brutal job market. Even here in New Hampshire, where unemployment's a lot lower than the national average, for every job open, there are two people looking. Given all that, Dabrowski and many of her colleagues want Congress to extend the unemployment benefits. But Employment Security Deputy Commissioner Daryl Gates says if that's going to happen, the system needs some tweaks.
I think it's important for the individuals that are in extended benefits to have more of an obligation to come into the offices every 2 weeks to show us proof that they have expanded their work search efforts.
Gates thinks stricter requirements would force people into looking harder and being more open to jobs that pay less. But he also wants Washington to send the states more money to focus on the people who need these extensions. He hopes a little extra counseling and training could be the difference between work and running out of benefits entirely. Before, Gates says, the true desperation sets in. In Concord, New Hampshire, I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Toyota today said it's going to continue reduced operations at its Thailand facility because of the impact from flooding there.
And oil's trading a little higher today at just over $100 a barrel.
And later, Mitchell, I'm sad. Chances are I'd be in which cities? Fresno?
No.
Flint?
Nuh-uh.
Fargo?
You're getting, well, colder.
Yes, I am. Fargo's super cold. Oh, my gosh.
But apparently it's not super sad. The list of some of the saddest cities in America ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
The Senate yesterday failed to agree on a deal that would extend payroll tax cuts, a key part of President Obama's stimulus plan. Now, right now, those tax cuts are boosting the average American's take-home pay by more than $1,000. But that extra pocket money will vanish if Democrats and Republicans cannot agree on how to pay for an extension. What economists can't agree on is whether the tax cuts help the economy. Marketplace's Heidi Moore explains that.
When you have a struggling economy like ours, the answer may seem simple. Put more money in people's pockets.
What you want to do with any sort of a tax cut now is increased demand. You want to put money in people's pockets so they spend it. They buy stuff. The people who make the stuff and sell the stuff hire more workers.
That's Howard Gleckman with the Tax Policy Center, but he's skeptical of this tax cut.
The bang for the buck for a tax cut like this, I think, is going to be relatively small.
That's because people are more likely to save than spend now, and this tax cut wouldn't be enough for employers to start hiring. Even so, MIT professor Michael Greenstone points out that this tax cut has been in place for years.
If the payroll tax cut isn't extended, households that earn less than $100,000 a year, roughly, will get a 2% tax increase.
Both experts say that while extending the payroll tax cut is a long shot, it's better than doing nothing at all. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
Now to the Marketplace global perspective. As we mentioned earlier, in Europe, German Chancellor Angela Merkel and other European leaders are outlining a new unified economic policy, which is reassuring investors at the moment and bringing down the borrowing costs for Italy and Spain. Marketplace's Stephen Beer joins me from our London bureau. Good morning, Stephen.
Hello, Mitchell.
So what is this plan that the German Chancellor laid out today?
Well, she addressed the central issue of this crisis, the fact that some governments in the Eurozone have spent more money than they could afford and as a result have run up unsustainable debts. Mrs. Merkel called for a new legally binding set of rules to control Eurozone government spending and for stiff penalties for those Eurozone governments that break the rules.
Now, we've heard similar proposals already, I think quite a few times, actually. Why is this one being taken more seriously by banks and also by investors?
It's the timing. It comes after a similar speech by the French president last night and a speech yesterday by the head of the European Central Bank. He indicated the bank would pump more money into the Eurozone if there was this move towards closer fiscal union. Now, this isn't the big bazooka that many investors have demanded. This isn't the bank printing money on a vast scale, but this is at least the three key players in this crisis, at last, all more or less on the same page. Daniel Gross of the Centre for European Policy Studies in Brussels thinks the most acute phase of this crisis has now passed, although the crisis certainly isn't over.
The rest of the world will have to live with a wobbly eurozone for quite some time. But it is very likely in the end the eurozone will actually emerge from this stronger than before.
Chancellor Merkel will discuss the planned budget reforms with the French president on Monday, and they'll present the plan to a crucial EU summit 1 week from today.
Thank you very much. Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London.
Okay, Mitchell.
So, Stephen, Mitchell, will the new plan work? The BBC's Steve Evans joins us now from Berlin, where Chancellor Merkel was speaking today. Good morning, Steve.
Hi, good morning to you.
I want you to sort of paint us a picture. What's this new improved eurozone going to look like?
Well, assuming they negotiate it, and that's a big if, it will be much tighter. There will be much more control of the finances of the individual countries. What Chancellor Merkel wants is strict rules for taxation and spending by all the 17 countries in the eurozone. And she wants treaties to be changed to enforce that. Big question, of course, is how can you enforce it? She reckons it can be done by the courts. If countries don't keep within their spending agreed limits, then they go to court. That's what she's proposing.
I know banks are already signaling that they believe this would reduce risk in Europe. Why is this plan any more effective than ones that have come out before?
I think that the markets are looking at the words spoken by the new head of the European Central Bank yesterday, where with a nudge and a wink, he seemed to be indicating that there'd be a bit more money available than under the old regime, if you like. What Mrs. Merkel said didn't sound that different to me from what she said before. But the markets are thinking, well, OK, she's talking tough to the German people, but actually there's a real change going on behind the scenes.
The BBC's Steve Evans in Berlin. Steve, thank you.
You're welcome.
Car sales are up this year, but not everyone can afford a car. Not everyone even wants one. That's especially true in Europe. As Caitlin Carroll reports from Berlin, German automakers see potential in the car-sharing business.
A line of young men wait at a Volkswagen shop in Hanover, Germany. They all want to register for VW's new car share program, Quick Car. 21-year-old Felix Zurich plans to visit his parents outside the city. But like many people his age,
don't have enough money to buy our own car.
So he wants to share one. The VW rep pastes a small electronic chip on Zurich's driver's license. The chip will unlock one of VW's 200 cars parked throughout the city. Other German automakers also want to connect with new customers like Zurich. BMW and Daimler have similar car share programs in place throughout Germany. Social science researcher Wirt Kanzler says it's a question of demographics.
The average age of Daimler customer is more than 50 years, so they have a problem with the young people.
According to a study, more than half of all young men in Germany were car owners a decade ago. Today, that number is down to a third. Kanzler says owning a car isn't as cool as it once was.
We have this small computers, we have this city trips. It's a kind of status symbol to say on Monday, last weekend I was in Barcelona. And you don't need the car as a status symbol.
To change that, German car companies are resorting to a tried and true marketing model. Give customers an opportunity to test drive a product and get them while they're young. Jürgen Osmer heads up marketing for VW's Quick Car program.
I think we would more than happy if people at the end of the day say, okay, I think we like Volkswagen so much that we would like to buy one. I think that would be a really nice benefit on that.
Daimler recently launched a car share program in Austin, and it plans to expand to San Diego next year. In Hanover, Germany, I'm Caitlin Carroll for Marketplace.
St. Petersburg, Florida, Detroit, Michigan, Memphis, Tennessee. Mm. If you live there, you might just be sad.
Oh.
These cities top a list of America's saddest places in Men's Health magazine. It crunched a bunch of numbers, including unemployment and use of antidepressants.
Huh.
At the other end of the list, the happiest people are in Honolulu.
Oh, of course they are.
Well, it may not be a surprise, but actually it's not the balmy weather.
Really?
Manchester, New Hampshire. Fargo, North Dakota.
Yeah, not balmy.
Come close behind.
Check out the list. It's at our website, marketplace.org. So we told you about the November jobs report out today, and that brought Americans relatively good news. But once people get those jobs, how productive are they? Well, one way to measure that is by how many days they're out of the office.
Well, a recent survey by Expedia finds the average American worker earned 14 days of vacation this year, but will end up using only 12. That means they give two back to the company. In today's Midday Extra, we ask, how much is vacation time worth? John Schmidt is senior economist with the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. Hey, John.
Hi.
So let's calculate this out. Missing these 2 days means $34 billion worth of time for the entire country. Is that a good or a bad thing for the economy?
Well, I think it's not such a good thing. I think we want to have workers have more vacation time, both because it is good for them and good for their families, but also because I think it's good for the economy in terms of productivity. Think about every time you go on vacation, when you come back refreshed, you come back eager to work a little bit harder, and I think that effect wears off fairly quickly. So we need to have a decent amount of vacation so that people can take a little bit of time out and then jump back in.
Yeah, get that little reset button hit, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm going to play the devil's advocate. Obviously, you come back and you have to catch up. The more time you take off, the more time you have to catch up before you're productive. Wouldn't it just be more productive to have those people in the office those other 2 days?
Well, I mean, obviously, you have to balance the effects. But I think in the United States, we're far closer to the burnout end than we are to the,
Is that an official title, the burnout
end? I think so. I think that's the UN has designated it that.
And where should we go live to be on the, the chill-out end, I guess?
Well, I mean, if you look at almost all of the other countries that are roughly our same level of economic development, the European countries, Australia, New Zealand, Japan, they have way more vacation than we do. The legal minimum in the European Union is 20 days per year, and almost every country has more than that, and almost every employer provides a little above that legal minimum. So we are far, far away from the norm in this regard.
Does this figure, fluctuate a lot from year to year, John? I mean, do people take fewer vacations maybe during a recession or when they're concerned about their jobs?
Well, I think that that's probably the case, but there's a fundamental issue in the U.S., which is that we have a lot of economic insecurity even when the unemployment rate is fairly low. We don't have a lot of job protections, and I think what people do is they're reluctant to take vacations because they don't want to miss the meeting where an important decision happens.
Right.
They don't want to be seen to be not the most valuable employee when decisions about promotions come around. So I think people in the United States live in a little bit more constant fear of not being seen to be super productive, and therefore they take these decisions to not use their vacation time.
And we also, I believe, get less of other kinds of time off, like parental leave and other things, right?
Yeah, we lag in almost every respect when it comes to paid time off. We don't have any requirement for paid family leave, paid parental leave. We don't have any legal requirements for paid sick days. Every other country, again, at roughly our level of economic development, has all of those guarantees for every worker, not just for kind of key workers.
How much vacation time do you take, John?
I take a fair amount, actually, I hope my boss isn't listening for all the reasons I just said. But I use all my vacation time every year.
Do you really? You don't like to leave any, like, I mean, do you get to carry over?
I think that is another important issue.
Yeah.
The one reason why people get 14 and only take 12 is because a lot of people use them as a time bank in case they get sick sometime in the future, in case they want to have a kid and they don't have paid parental leave, if to tide them over between jobs. A lot of employers pay out the vacation that's due at the end if you leave, and that might be the only kind of severance pay that somebody gets. So there's that element of economic insecurity that's driving that decision too.
John Schmidt is senior economist for the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, the Green Bay Packers have announced details of their latest stock sale today. Maybe people will take a couple days off for this. Who knows? The team is the only publicly owned franchise in the four big sports, and it's looking for more than $140 million to upgrade its stadium, Lambeau Field. and hopes to raise part of that money by selling stock to its fans. But there is a catch. The stock isn't worth anything in dollars, Sally Herships reports.
Imagine owning a stock whose price doesn't go up, doesn't pay a dividend, and can never be sold. These are some of the strings attached to shares in the Green Bay Packers. But Packers fan Kent Kenigy says the last time the stock was available, he didn't buy. This time, he's ready to spend $250 on a share.
I've already told my wife, I said, if it ever happens again, I said, I'm taking hold of one of them babies.
Speaking of babies, that's one of the things you are allowed to do with a share in the Packers. Pass it on to family members.
With the big cities, organizations, they're owned by families and, you know, different entities, but not the Green Bay Packers, man. The people own them.
Over 112,000 fans have bought shares in the Packers. The team doesn't sell stadium naming rights or allow big ticket advertising deals. So when the Packers need money, they sell stock. This is the fifth sale ever, which is a lot for what investors get. Andrew Zimbalist is a sports economist at Smith.
Basically, it's a trophy or it's a vanity purchase. You don't really get anything of value.
Except for special access to sales on the Packers website and a piece of the defending Super Bowl champions. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
And finally this morning, here's an idea for government officials who have to deal with unhappy business owners, Mitchell. Remember who you're dealing with. This is the thought of the day, the cautionary tale, if you will. In India, local officials allegedly threw up so many government roadblocks and charged so much in bribes that a local property owner decided to fight back in his own way. See, the man was a snake charmer. You know these remember those?
I do remember.
Yeah, with the basket. Yeah.
From the cartoons.
Of course, from the cartoons. And he applied to raise all his snakes on government land in India. And the bureaucracy got him so angry that he marched right on down to the government offices there, and he released all his snakes, including some venomous, nasty-looking cobras, in the middle of the workday. People were scrambling everywhere. They jumped on their desks. They ran into offices and closets. No one was bitten, thankfully. We don't know where it's going to wind up, though. Those snakes are still being gathered in the offices as we speak. We don't know. Maybe they boarded a couple of airplanes, too. They might make a movie out of that.
I don't know. It's like make work for other snake charmers.
In Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Mitchell Hartman. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
Have a great weekend. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.